Old sames until we die. Our hearts are glad. Madam Wong watched us solemnly as we both signed our names.
I am happy with this Lao Tang mat, she announced. Unlike marriage, this relationship should remain exclusive. No, and here she allowed herself a small cackle. Concubines allowed. You understand my meaning, girls? This is a joining of two hearts that cannot be torn apart by distance, disagreement, loneliness, better marriage position, or by letting other girls and later women come between you.
We took our 10 steps back to the palanquin. For so many months, walking had been agony, but right then my seat felt cushioned by great happiness. The bearers carried us to the center of the fair. This time when we got out, Madam Wong slipped us each a piece of cash and told us to buy gifts to celebrate the day. I tried to think of what this girl beside me could want.
Thankfully, Snowflower took charge again. I know just the thing, she squealed. She pulled me into a stall that sold embroidery necessities.
We are two girls in our daughter days, Snowflower said as her eyes scanned the rainbow of threads. Until we marry out, we will be visiting together, embroidering together, whispering together. If we buy carefully, we will have memories we can make together for many years. We went back to the palanquin with our purchases in hand. Once we were back inside, Snowflower implored Madam Wong for one more treat.
Auntie, please take us to the tarot man. Please, Auntie, please.
Assuming that Snowflower was using this honorific to soften Madam Wong's stern demeanor, and emboldened by my Lao tongue's daring, I joined in.
Please, Auntie, please.
Madam Wong could not say no with a girl on either side of her, each begging for another extravagance as only a first son might do. She finally gave in with warnings that this sort of thing could not happen again.
I am just a poor widow, and spending my money on 2 useless branches will lower my esteem in the county. Do you want to send me into poverty?
She said all of this in her usual abrupt manner, but actually everything was ready for us when we reached the stand. A short table had been set up with 3 small barrels for seats. The proprietor brought out a live chicken and held it up.
I always select the best for you, Madam Wong, old man Zhou said.
A few minutes later, he carried out a special pot heated by coals in a bottom compartment. Broth, ginger, scallions, and the cut-up chicken we'd seen just moments before bubbled inside the bowl. A dipping sauce of chopped ginger, garlic, scallions, and hot oil was also set on the table. We ate with relish, fishing for delectable pieces of chicken with our chopsticks. But as wonderful as all this was, I still kept room for the taro dish that Snowflower had mentioned earlier. Everything she said about it was true. The way the hot sugar crackled as it hit the water, the irresistible crunch and softness in my mouth. This was our first trip to She Xia and the Temple of Gu Po. Madam Wong would escort us there almost every year until our daughter days were over. Once Snowflower and I married out, we met in She Xia each year if circumstances allowed, always making offerings in the temple so that we might have sons, always visiting the thread merchant, always reliving the details of our first visit, and always stopping to have old man Zhou's caramelized taro at the end of the day. We reached Puwei at dusk. I didn't want the day to end, but I knew it would as soon as we reached my house. Then I learned my happiness was not yet over. We stopped and I got out. Madam Wong told Snowflower to step out too.
Goodbye, girls. I will be back in a few days to retrieve Snowflower.
She leaned out of the palanquin, pinched my old same's cheeks, and added,
Be good. Don't complain. Make your mother proud of you.
How can I explain what I felt with us standing outside my family's threshold? I was beyond happy, but as much as I love my family and our home, I knew Snowflower was accustomed to something better, and she had not brought any clothes or toiletries with her. Mama came out to greet us. She kissed me. Then she put an arm around Snowflower's shoulders and guided her over the threshold into our home. Snowflower met everyone, even elder brother. When dinner was served, Snowflower dipped her chopsticks first in her cup of tea to clean them. But other than this small gesture, which showed more refinement than anyone in my family had ever seen, she did her best to hide her feelings. It had been a long day, and we were very tired. When it came time to go upstairs, Mama pointed out a bowl of fresh water for us to wash up, along with two sets of my clothes and one of Elder Sister's, all freshly cleaned, for Snowflower to wear while she was our guest. I let Snowflower use the water bowl first, but she barely dabbed her fingers into it, suspicious, I think, that it was not pure enough. She held the sleeping garment I gave her away from her body, scrutinizing it. She looked around, saw our eyes on her, and then without a word, stripped and put on the garment. We climbed into bed. Tonight, and for all future nights when Snowflower came to stay, Elder Sister would sleep with Beautiful Moon. Mama said goodnight to the two of us, then she leaned down, kissed me, and whispered in my ear, "Madam Wong told us what we needed to do. Be happy, little one. Be happy." So there we were, the two of us side by side. Moonlight came in through the lattice window. Snowflower snuggled close to me so that we were face to face. She put her hand on my cheek and said, "I am happy we are old Sames." Then she closed her eyes and fell asleep. Lying next to her, looking at her face in the moonlight, feeling the delicate weight of her small hand on my cheek, listening to her breathing deepen, I wondered how could I make her love me the way I longed to be loved. Maybe I could make our love grow like a farmer made his crop to grow, through hard work, unwavering will, and the blessings of nature. How funny that I can remember that even now. Wah! I knew so little about life, but I knew enough to think like a farmer. So over the next few weeks, I prepared my earth, getting a piece of paper from Baba or asking Elder Sister for a tiny scrap of her dowry cloth on which to plant. My seeds were the new shoe characters I composed. Madam Wong became my irrigation ditch. When she stopped by to see how my feet were progressing, I gave her my missive in the form of a letter, a piece of weaving, or an embroidered handkerchief, and she delivered it to Snowflower. Sunshine came in the form of her answers to my new shoe letters. When I received something from Snowflower, all of us gathered to decipher the meaning, for she already used words and images that challenged Aunt's knowledge. I wrote little girl things. "I am fine. How are you?" She might respond, "Two birds balance on the top branches of a tree. Together they fly into the sky." I might write, "Today Mama taught me how to make sticky rice wrapped in taro leaf." Snowflower might write back, "Today I looked out my lattice window. I thought of the phoenix rising to find a companion, and then I thought of you." Her words both frightened and exhilarated me. In every message she spoke of birds, of flight, of the world away. Even back then she flew against what was presented to her. I wanted to cling to her wings and soar, no matter how intimidated I was. Except for the initial delivery of the fan, Snowflower never sent anything to me without my sending something to her first. This did not bother me, but one obstacle confounded me. I wanted to see her again. She needed to invite me to her home, but an invitation did not come. One day, Madam Wong came to visit, this time bringing the fan. I clicked open only the first three folds, revealing her first message to me, my response next to it, and now a new communication next to that. "If your family agrees, I would like to come to you in the 11th month. We will sit together, thread our needles, choose our colors, and talk in whispers." In the garland of leaves, she had added another delicate flower. On the chosen day, I waited by the lattice window, watching for the palanquin. When it stopped before our threshold, Snowflower stepped down. She wore the same sky-blue jacket with the cloud pattern. In time, I came to think of it as her traveling tunic and believe she wore it for every visit so as not to embarrass my family for our lack. She had brought neither food nor clothes with her, as was the custom. Mama carried Snowflower upstairs, and from the minute her feet hit the floor of the women's chamber, she couldn't stop talking. I had told her I wanted to be her student. So she started that day to teach me things from the women's classic, like never to show my teeth when I smiled or raise my voice when talking to a man. But she had written that she wanted to be my student too. So she asked me to show her how to make those sticky rice cakes. She also asked strange questions about hauling water and making pig feed. I laughed because every girl knows those things. Snowflower swore she didn't. The time came for us to wash our faces before bed. I motioned for her to go first, but she said, "We'll wash our faces together." I knew then that all my common farmer's work and willfulness had produced my desired crop. Together we bent over the basin, cupped our hands, and scooped water onto our faces. She nudged me with her elbow. I looked into the water and saw our two faces reflecting back through the ripples. In that moment of shared water, I knew that my Lao Tang loved me too. During the next 3 years, Snowflower visited every couple of months. Her sky blue tunic with a cloud pattern gave way to another outfit of lavender silk with white trim, an odd color combination for a girl so young. As soon as she entered the upstairs chamber, she changed into an outfit that my mother had made for her. In this way, we were old sames on the inside and on the outside as well. I had yet to go to Snowflower's home village of Tongku. I didn't question this. Then one day when I was 9, I overheard Mama query Madame Wang about the situation. They were standing outside the threshold, and their conversation carried up to me at my spot by the lattice window. "My husband says we are always feeding Snowflower," Mama said. "He wants to know when Lily will visit Tongku. This is the usual way."
"The usual custom is for all 8 characters to be matched," Madame Wang reminded my mother. "But we both know that Snowflower has come to a family that is below her. I told you from the beginning that I hoped to find a match for Lily in Tongku, but a marriage could never happen there if a potential bridegroom happened to glimpse your daughter before the wedding day. Furthermore, Snowflower's family suffers because of the girl's social imbalance. You should be grateful that they haven't demanded an end to the Lao Tang agreement."
Are you wondering how I felt, hearing that Snowflower's family didn't feel I was her equal? It didn't disturb me, because I knew I didn't deserve Snowflower's affections. And the truth is, I didn't care about Baba's concerns or the peculiar physical design of Snowflower in my relationship, because even if I could have visited Tongku without my future husband seeing me, I felt I didn't need to go there to know about my Lao Tang's life. She had already told me more about her village, her family, and her beautiful home than I could ever have learned just by seeing them. But the matter didn't end there. Madame Wang and Madame Gao always fought over territory. As the go-between for people in Puwei, Madame Gao had negotiated a good marriage for elder sister and had found a suitable girl from another village for elder brother. She had expected to do the same for Beautiful Moon and me. But Madame Wang had changed not only my course and that of Beautiful Moon's, but Madame Gao's as well. Those monies would no longer go into her purse. As they say, a miserly woman always nurses revenge. Madame Gao traveled to Tongku to suggest her services to Snowflower's family. It didn't take long before word of this reached Madame Wang. While the disagreement had nothing to do with us, the confrontation took place in our house when Madame Wang came to pick up Snowflower and found Madame Gao in our upstairs chamber bragging about her matchmaking expertise. Finally, Madame Wang couldn't take any more.
"Only a she-dog in heat would be demented enough to come to my village and try to steal one of my little nieces," Madame Wang snapped.
"Tongku is not your village, old auntie," Madame Gao answered. "If it is your village to master, why do you come sniffing around Puwei? By your reckoning, Lily and Beautiful Moon should be mine. But do I cry wah wah like a baby over this? I'll make fine matches for those girls. I will for Snowflower too. You couldn't do better." "Don't be so sure. You did not do so well for her elder sister. I'm better suited, given Snowflower's circumstances."
Did I mention that Snowflower was in the room hearing these words? She had been standing by Madame Wang waiting to go home. I could see that her face and ears had turned bright red. At this point, the argument could have escalated. Instead, Madame Wong reached out a veined hand and placed it gently on the small of Snowflower's back. Until that time, I hadn't known that Madame Wong was capable of either pity or backing down.
"I do not speak to gutter women," she rasped. "Come, Snowflower, we have a long journey home."
By the time Snowflower and I turned 13, our feet had completely healed. Mine was strong and noticeably perfect at just 7 centimeters long. Snowflower's feet were slightly larger, while Beautiful Moon's feet were larger still but exquisitely shaped. With our foot binding behind us, Madame Wong negotiated the contracting akin phase for all three of our marriages. Our 8 characters were matched with our future husbands and engagement dates selected. Just as Madame Wong predicted, the perfection of my golden lilies led me to a fortuitous betrothal. She arranged for me to be married into the best Lu family in Tongku. My husband's uncle was a Jinshi scholar who had received much land from the emperor as an enfeoffment. Uncle Lu, as he was called, was childless. He lived in the capital and relied on his brother to oversee his holdings. Since my father-in-law served as headman of the village, renting tracts to farmers and collecting rents, everyone assumed my husband would become the future headman. Beautiful Moon was going to marry into a lesser Lu family nearby. Her betrothed was the son of a farmer who worked 4 times as many mu as Baba and Uncle. To us, this seemed prosperous, but it was still far, far less than what my future father-in-law controlled on his brother's behalf. Beautiful Moon and I were grateful that we would continue to share everything, from our rice and salt days as wives and mothers to sitting quietly as widows. Snowflower had to marry out of Tongku, but she would be close by in Jinqian. Madame Wong guaranteed that Beautiful Moon and I would be able to see Snowflower's window from our new lattice windows. Our groom's families delivered the first gifts of money, candy, and meat. Our parents reciprocated with gifts to the groom's families of eggs and rice to symbolize our fertility. Then we waited for the second stage to begin, when our future in-laws would deliver the date for our weddings. Aunt continued to teach us new shu, but we also learned from Snowflower, who brought new characters with her every time she visited. We spent hours practicing them, tracing the strokes with our fingers on each other's palms. Always Aunt cautioned us to be careful with our words, since by using phonetic characters as opposed to the pictographic characters of men's writings, our meanings could become lost or confused. Every word must be placed in context, she reminded us each day at the end of our lesson. Much tragedy could result from a wrong reading. My desire for knowledge went far beyond what I needed to know in the upstairs women's chamber, in downstairs areas, or even with the study of new shu. I wanted to know about my future. Fortunately, Snowflower loved to talk, and she talked a lot about Tongku. "When you go to your husband," she told me, "you will pass over the river and through many rice paddies, heading for the low hills that you can see from the edge of Puwei. Tongku nestles in the arms of those hills. In Tongku, we are protected from earthquake, famine, and marauders. It is feng shui perfect." Listening to Snowflower, Tongku grew in my imagination, but this was nothing compared to how I felt when she talked about my husband and my future in-laws. "You are lucky, Lily. I have seen this Lu boy. He is my cousin twice removed. His hair is the blue-black of night. He is kind to girls." She told me that my future husband was born in the year of the tiger, a sign that is as spirited as mine, which made us perfectly suited. She told me things I would need to know to fit into the Lu family. "It is a busy household. There are no daughters, but daughters-in-law will marry in. You will be daughter-in-law number 1. Your ranking will be high to start. If you have a son first, your ranking will hold true forever. Even though Master Lu's wife has given him 4 sons, he has 3 concubines.
He must have them because he is the head man. They help show the people his strength.
Your mother-in-law is very traditional. She follows all the women's rules. She is well attired, and when guests come, hot tea is always at the ready. There are more servants in the house than I have had in my family. You will not have to cook except to make special dishes for Lady Lu. You are so lucky. Snowflower and I had now gone to the Temple of Gupo in Shexia 7 times. Each year we climbed the stairs to the temple, placed our offerings on the altar, and lit incense. Then we walked to the marketplace, where we bought embroidery thread and paper. We always ended the day with a visit to Old Man Zhou to have his burnt sugar taro. All during this time, Madame Wang and Madame Gao were in and out of our house like a pair of busy hens. But in my 13th summer, the battle between the two matchmakers suddenly escalated. We were in the upstairs chamber when Madame Gao began complaining.
A peasant uprising in the hills is making things difficult for all of us, Madame Gao opined. No products come in and no products go out. No one has cash. I have heard that some girls have had to give up their betrothals because their families can no longer provide dowries. Those girls will now become little daughters-in-law.
That things had become so difficult in our county was not news, but what Madame Gao said next surprised us all.
Even little Miss Snowflower is not safe. It's not too late for me to look for someone more appropriate.
I was glad that Snowflower was not here to hear this.
You are speaking of a family that is among the best in the county, Madame Wang countered.
Perhaps, old auntie, you mean was. That master has seen too much gambling and too many concubines. The whole county knows what's happening to that family. Take trouble in the hills and combine it with bad crops and inattention, and nothing can be expected but that a weak man will take to the pipe.
My mother rose abruptly. Madame Gao, I am grateful for the things you have done for my children. But they are children and should not hear this. I will see you to the threshold. Mama practically dragged her to the stairs. At the time, I didn't understand half of what was said. The 10th month of my 13th year arrived. Outside the lattice window, the white-hot sky of summer eased into the deep blue of autumn. Only 1 month remained until elder sister's wedding. The groom's family delivered the last round of gifts. Elder sister's sworn sisters sold 1 of their 25 gin of rice, and gifts were bought. The girls came to stay with us for sitting and singing in the upstairs chamber. Other village women visited to socialize, give advice, and commiserate. For 28 days, we sang songs and told stories. Together, we all worked on the third-day wedding books that would be given to elder sister. These would introduce her to the women in her new family, and we all struggled with the right words to describe her best attributes and characteristics. 3 days before elder sister went to her new home, we had the day of sorrow and worry. Mama sat on the 4th step to the upstairs chamber with her feet on the 3rd step and began a lament.
"Elder daughter, you were a pearl in my hand," she chanted. "My eyes doubly flood with tears. Twin streams pour down my face. Soon there will be an empty space."
Elder sister, her sworn sisters, and the village women began to weep upon hearing my mother's sadness. Coo, coo, coo. Aunt sang next, following the rhythm my mother had set. As always, Aunt tried to be optimistic in the midst of sorrow.
"I am ugly and not so smart, but I have loved my husband and he has loved me. We are a pair of ugly and not so smart mandarin ducks. We have had much bed fun. I hope you will too."
When my turn came, I lifted my voice.
"Elder sister, my heart cries to lose you. If we had been sons, we would not be torn apart. The upstairs chamber will be lonely without you."
The sworn sisters followed me.
When the last girl married out, their treasured sworn sisterhood would dissolve. They would only have memories of embroidering and weaving together. They would only have the words in their third-day wedding books to console them in the years to come. Our family was sad, but except for conjugal visits a few times a year, she would continue to live with us until the end of her first pregnancy. Of all the events of elder sister's marriage, what I remember most is when she returned after a nuptial visit to her husband's home the following spring. She was usually so peaceful, but now she knelt on the floor with her face buried in Mama's lap, weeping her woes. Her mother-in-law was abusive, always complaining and criticizing. Her husband was unknowledgeable and rough. Beautiful Moon, Snowflower, and I huddled together, making clucking sounds of commiseration. But inside, although we were sorry for elder sister, we believed this kind of thing would never happen to us. Mama smoothed elder sister's hair and patted her trembling form. With helplessness in her eyes, Mama looked to Aunt for guidance.
"I am 38 years old," Aunt said, not with sympathy but with resignation. "I have lived a miserable life. My family was a good one, but my feet and my face made my destiny. My father married me to the best family he could find to take me. I cried like you do now. Fate was crueler still. I could not have sons. I was a burden to my in-laws. I wish my daughter would never marry out so that I would have her to hear my sorrows. But this is how it is for women. You can't avoid your fate. It is predestined." These sentiments coming from my aunt, the one person in our household who could always be counted on to say something funny, who always talked about how happy she and uncle were with their bed fund, who always guided us in our studies with good cheer, were a shock. Beautiful Moon's eyes filled with tears at this truth, which had not been spoken aloud. Never before had I thought about how hard life had been for Aunt. Needless to say, these words did not comfort elder sister.
Hairpinning days. Snowflower and I turned 15. Our hair was pinned up in the style of phoenixes as symbols that we were soon to be married. We worked on our dowries in earnest. That year, Snowflower came to stay with us for all of Catching Cool Breezes Festival, which takes place during the hottest time of year when the stores from the previous harvests are nearly gone and the new harvest is not yet ready. This means that married-in women, the lowest in any household, are sent back to their natal homes. We call it a festival, but it is really a series of days that remove unwanted eaters from their in-laws' tables. Elder sister had just moved into her husband's home permanently. Her first child was about to be born. Mama was visiting her family and had taken second brother with her. Aunt had also gone to her natal home, while Beautiful Moon was staying with her sworn sisters across the village. Elder brother's wife and baby daughter were catching cool breezes with her natal family. Baba, uncle, and elder brother were happy to be left alone. They wanted nothing from Snowflower and me except hot tea, tobacco, and sliced watermelon. So for 3 days and nights of the weeks-long Catching Cool Breezes festival, Snowflower and I were alone in the upstairs chamber. On the first night, we lay side by side, wearing our bindings and sleeping slippers, our inner garments and our outer garments. We pushed our bed under the lattice window, hoping to catch a cool breeze, but there was none. The moon would be full soon. The light beams that streamed in reflected off our sweaty faces, making us feel even hotter. The next night, Snowflower suggested we shed our outer garments. It brought relief, but we longed for something cooler. On our third night alone together, the moon was full, and the upstairs chamber was awash in a bright blue glow. When we were sure the men were sleeping, we peeled off our outer and inner garments. We wore nothing but our bindings and our sleeping slippers. "This is not enough," Snowflower said, stealing my thought right out of my mind. She sat up and reached for our fan.
Slowly, she began to wave it back and forth over my body. It was a luxurious feeling, but Snowflower closed the fan and set it aside. She searched my face, then let her eyes travel down my neck across my breasts to the flat of my stomach. I should have felt embarrassed, but she was my Lao Tong, my old same. There was nothing to be ashamed of. Looking up, I saw her bring her forefinger to her mouth. The tip of her tongue darted out. Then she brought her finger down to my stomach. She drew a line to the left, then another in the opposite direction, followed by something like two crosses. The wetness was so cool on my skin that goosebumps rose up. I shut my eyes and let the feeling ripple through me. When I opened my eyes, Snowflower was staring into them.
"Well, it's a character. Tell me which one it is."
Suddenly, I understood what she'd done. She'd written a new shoe character on my stomach.
"I'll do it again," she said, "but pay attention."
As soon as that wetness touched my skin, I couldn't help closing my eyes. The feeling made my body heavy and breathless. Again, I kept my eyes closed until the momentary chill left my body. When I opened them, Snowflower was looking down at me, inquisitively. "Bed," I said.
"That's right," she said, her voice low. "Close your eyes. I will write another."
This time she wrote the character in a spot just next to my right hip bone. This one I recognized immediately. It was a verb that meant to light. The next character swirled across my stomach next to the opposite hip bone. "Moonlight," I said. I opened my eyes. "The bed is lit by moonlight." She smiled at my recognition of the opening line to the Tang Dynasty poem she had taught me. Then we switched positions. As she had done with me, I took time to look at her body, the small mounds that formed her breasts, the flat expanse of her stomach that was as inviting as a new piece of silk waiting for embroidery stitches. I licked my finger and looked at the whiteness of Snowflower's skin. I was eager for her to experience what I had felt. I thought I was hot these past nights, but now, naked in the moonlight, I felt as though a fire burned inside me, far hotter than anything the gods could inflict on us. My characters were high up on her thighs. I leaned down to concentrate on writing the most perfect characters possible. I blew on my strokes, knowing the sensation it would cause, and watched as the hair between her legs swayed in response. Afterward, we recited the entire poem together. "The bed is lit by moonlight. I think it is the light snow of an early winter morning. Looking up, I enjoy the full moon in the night sky. Bending over, I miss my hometown." We all know that poem is about a scholar who is traveling and missing his home. But on that night and forever after, I believed it was about us. Snowflower was my home, and I was hers. Beautiful Moon returned the next day, and we got back to work. Months ago, each of our future in-laws had delivered the dates for our weddings, along with the first installments of our official bride prices, more pork and candy, as well as empty wooden boxes to fill with all the things we would make for our dowries. Finally, and most important, they sent cloth. I could only compare my bridal cloth to that used in Snowflower's tunics, trousers, and headdresses, which had been constructed from beautiful fabrics and sophisticated patterns into a stylish wardrobe. One of my favorite outfits she wore in those days was made from indigo cloth. The intricate design of the indigo and the cut of the jacket were better than anything the married women in Pu Wei owned or made. Still, Snowflower wore it with ease until it started to fade and fray. What I'm trying to say is that the cloth and its cut inspired me. I wanted to make clothes for myself that would be suitable for everyday wear in Tang Ku. What arrived for me was not only of fine quality, but perfect in color.
red for marriage, but also for anniversaries, New Year's celebrations, and other festivities. Purple and green, both appropriate for a young wife. A bluish-gray, the color of the sky before a storm, and a bluish-green, the color of a village pond in summer, for my years as a matron and later a widow. Black and dark blue for the men in my new home. Some of the silks were plain, while others had been woven to include double happiness, peony, or cloud patterns. The rolls of silk and cotton my in-law sent were to be used in preparing my dowry, just as Beautiful Moon and Snowflower had to use their gifts to build their dowries. We had to make enough quilts, pillowcases, shoes, and clothes to last a lifetime, since Yao nationality women believe they should never take anything from their in-laws. What we loved to make were shoes. We made them for our husbands, our mothers-in-law, our fathers-in-law, and anyone else who lived in our new home. Our future families had sent patterns for their feet. We had not met our husbands, but we knew the size of their feet. We were young girls, romantic as anyone of that age, and we imagined all kinds of things about our husbands from those patterns. As I said, it was unbearably hot that year during catching cool breezes. We sweltered in the upstairs chamber. Downstairs was only slightly better. Baba and Uncle took pity on us. We didn't have an inner courtyard to lounge in, or any place where we would be completely shielded from the eyes of strangers. Instead, Baba took some of Mama's cloth and, with Uncle's help, strung a canopy for us on the north side of the house. Then they laid some padded winter quilts on the ground so we might have something soft to sit on. "The men are in the fields during the day," Baba said. "They will not see you. Until the weather changes, you girls may do your work here. Just don't tell your mothers." Beautiful Moon was accustomed to walking to her sworn sisters' houses for embroidery sessions and the like, but I had not been outdoors in Puwei like this since my milk years. We were gloriously happy. Still hot, but happy. As we sat in the shade, actually catching a cool breeze as the festival promised, we embroidered the tops of shoes. Snowflower had just finished a pair in sky blue silk with a cloud pattern for her mother-in-law. They filled me with happiness, bringing to mind the jacket that Snowflower had worn on the first day we'd met. But nostalgic thoughts didn't seem to interest Snowflower. She had simply moved on to a pair for herself, which employed purple silk trimmed with white. Meanwhile, I was finishing a pair of shoes for my mother-in-law. Her shoe size was slightly larger than my own, and it filled me with pride to know that, based solely on my feet, she would have to consider me worthy of her son. I was interrupted from these thoughts by something that sounded like a sob. I looked at Beautiful Moon, who was brushing at her neck and taking great breaths. "What's wrong?" I asked. Beautiful Moon's chest heaved with the effort of drawing in air. She looked at me with her lovely eyes. Her hand stopped brushing and clasped the side of her neck. But I could see that beneath her hand, her neck had begun to swell. "Snowflower, find help," I said urgently. "Get Baba, get Uncle, quick!" I crawled across the quilt to Beautiful Moon's side. I saw on her embroidery a bee struggling for life. The stinger had to be in my cousin's neck. I took her other hand and held it in my own. Her mouth open, inside her tongue was growing, engorging. Somewhere in the village I heard Snowflower, "Baba, Uncle, Elder Brother, anyone, help us!" Beautiful Moon's eyes locked with mine. "Beautiful Moon, listen to me," I pleaded. "Your Baba is coming. Wait for him. He loves you so much. We all love you, Beautiful Moon. Do you hear me?" Beautiful Moon took another breath. This one sounded like a creaking hinge. Almost no air could enter her body. "Beautiful Moon, Beautiful Moon." The horrible sound ended. Her eyes were just slits in a face cruelly distorted, but she looked at me with full understanding. In the last moment of her life, I felt as though she passed on to me many messages. "Tell Mama I love her. Tell Baba I love him. Tell your parents I am grateful for all they have done for me. Don't let the men suffer for me." Then her head tipped forward onto her chest. Uncle ran to the quilt where Beautiful Moon and I sat. tears poured from his eyes. Baba arrived and knelt beside me. A few seconds later, elder brother broke through the crowd, panting, Snowflower on his back. Uncle kept talking to Beautiful Moon. Wake up, little one. Wake up. I will get your mama. She needs you. Wake up. Wake up. When he realized that Aunt would have to be told about Beautiful Moon's death, Uncle's sobs grew deeper. I could barely think about Aunt myself. Beautiful Moon had been her one true happiness. Baba tried to comfort Uncle, but what was the use? He could not be comforted. Anyone who tells you that the Yao people never care for their daughters is lying. We may be worthless, we may be raised for another family, but often we are loved and cherished. Why else in our secret writing do you see phrases like, I was a pearl in my father's palm so frequently? Uncle's pearl was gone from him, forever. Aunt did everything properly for the funeral. She went to the burial on her knees. She burned paper money and clothes at the site for Beautiful Moon to use in the afterworld. She gathered together all of Beautiful Moon's secret writing and burned that too. Afterward, she created a little altar in our house where she made offerings every day. She did not cry in our presence, but I will never forget the sounds that emanated through our house at night when Aunt went to bed. She moaned from some deep, deep part of her soul. None of us could sleep. Everyone knows that part of the spirit descends to the afterworld, while part of it remains with the family. But we have a special belief about the spirit of a young woman who has died before her marriage that goes contrary to this. She comes back to prey upon other unmarried girls, not to scare them, but to take them to the afterworld with her so she might have company. The way Beautiful Moon's unhappiness came to us every night in Aunt's otherworldly moans let Snowflower and me know we were in danger. Snowflower came up with a plan. A flower tower must be made, she said one morning. A flower tower was exactly what was needed to appease Beautiful Moon's spirit. If we provided her with a good flower tower, she would have a place to entertain herself. If she were happy, Snowflower and I would be protected. We envisioned a tower like a 7-tiered pagoda. We made one level for dancing. We made a sleeping room with stars and the moon painted on the ceiling. On another level, we made a women's chamber with lattice windows. We constructed a table on which we laid out bits of our favorite threads, some ink, paper, and a brush, so Beautiful Moon might embroider or write letters in Nyushu to her new ghost friends. On the day the weather finally broke, Snowflower and I asked and received permission to go to Beautiful Moon's grave. Snowflower set the flower tower on fire. We watched it burn, imagining it being transported to the afterworld and Beautiful Moon drifting through the rooms in delight. Snowflower and I walked home and went upstairs to the women's chamber. Sitting side by side, we took turns writing a lament onto the folds of our special fan. When we were done, I added to the garland at the top a crescent-shaped moon, as slender and unobtrusive as Beautiful Moon herself. The flower tower helped protect Snowflower and me, and it placated Beautiful Moon's restless spirit, but it did nothing for Aunt and Uncle, who could not be consoled. 2 years after Beautiful Moon died, my hair, which had already been pinned when I was 15, was combed into the dragon style befitting a young woman about to marry. My in-laws sent more cloth, cash so that I might have my own purse, and jewelry, earrings, rings, necklaces, all in silver and jade. They also gave my parents 30 bundles of glutinous rice, enough to feed family and friends who would visit in the days to come, and a side of pork, which Baba sliced and my brothers delivered to people in Puwei village, to let them know that the month-long wedding celebration had officially begun. But what surprised and pleased Baba most of all, and what showed that our family's hard work in preparing me for my special future had paid off, was the arrival of a new water buffalo. With this single gift, my father became one of the three most prosperous men in our village. Snowflower came for the entire month of sitting and singing in the upstairs chamber. We both had foolish ideas about what marriage would be, but Snowflower and I believed nothing would ever come close to the comfort we felt in each other's arms. The warmth of our bodies, the softness of our skin, the delicate smells. Nothing would ever alter our love, and when we looked ahead, we thought we would have only more to share. In many ways, I was sad I would be leaving my family, but I was convinced that a new and better future lay ahead of me. Perhaps it was something in my nature. A horse would wander the world if it could. I was happy to be going somewhere new. I thought that Snowflower, my old same, would feel the same as I did, but she was a mystery to me. Snowflower's wedding was a month after mine, but she seemed neither excited nor sad. I thought perhaps she was more nervous than I was about the wedding night.
"I'm not afraid of that," she quipped, as we folded and wrapped my quilts. "I'm not either," I said, but I don't think either of us spoke with much conviction.
In my daughter days, when I'd still been allowed to play outside, I'd seen animals do bed business. I knew I was going to do something like that, but I didn't understand how it would happen or what I was supposed to do, and Snowflower, who usually knew so much more than I did, was no help. Since we were both uncomfortable with the topic, I tried to guide the conversation toward our plan for the next few weeks. Instead of returning home immediately after my marriage, I would go straight to Snowflower's house for her month of sitting and singing. I had been wanting to go to her house for 10 years now, and in some ways I was more excited about that than in meeting my husband. But she seemed vague about the details.
"Do you think my mother-in-law will join us for your sitting and singing?" I asked.
This would please me, because she would see me with my Lao tongue.
"Lady Lu is too busy. She has many duties, just as you will one day.
But I'll get to meet your mother, elder sister, and who else will be invited?" I had expected that Mama and Aunt would be part of Snowflower's rituals. She seemed so much a member of our family that I thought she would want them there. "Auntie Wong will come," she said. The matchmaker would probably make several appearances during Snowflower's sitting and singing, just as she had at mine. "Other than Auntie Wong's presence, I don't know what my mother has planned," Snowflower continued. "Everything will be a surprise." I glanced at her, and her features seemed tight. For the first time in many years, my old insecurities bubbled up. Did Snowflower still feel I was unworthy of her? Was she embarrassed to have the women of Tongku meet my mother and aunt? Then I remembered that we were talking about her sitting and singing. I took a strand of Snowflower's hair and tucked it behind her ear. "I can't wait to meet your family. It's going to be a happy time." She still seemed drawn as she said, "I worry that you'll be disappointed. I've said so much about my mama and baba, and Tongku and your house. Oh, how can they be as good as what you've imagined?" I laughed. "You're silly to worry. Everything I have in my mind comes from your beautiful word pictures." 3 days before my wedding, we had the day of sorrow and worry. Mama sat on the fourth step leading to the upstairs chamber. The women of our village came to witness the laments, and everyone went coo, coo, coo with much sobbing all around. I may have been brave and looking forward to my new life, but my body and soul were weak from hunger because a bride is not allowed to eat for the final 10 days of her wedding festivities. Do we follow this custom to make us sadder at leaving our families, to make us more yielding when we go to our husbands' homes? How can I know the answer? All I know is that Mama, like most mothers, hid a few hard-boiled eggs for me in the women's chamber, but these did little to give me strength, and my emotions weakened with each new event. The next morning, nervousness jolted me awake, but Snowflower was right beside me, her soft fingers on my cheek, trying to calm me. She helped me put on the wedding outfit I had made, a short, collarless jacket cinched with a belt over long pants.
She slipped the silver bangles my husband's family had sent onto my wrist, then helped me put on their other gifts, the earrings, necklace, and hairpins. My bracelets jangled together, while the silver charms I'd sewn onto my jacket tinkled harmoniously. On my feet I wore my red wedding shoes, and on my head an elaborate headdress with pearly balls and silver trinkets, all of which quivered when I walked or moved my head or when my feelings broke through. Red tassels hung down in front of my headdress, forming a veil. The only way I could see was to look straight down. Suddenly we heard music. They were almost here. Snowflower and I went to the lattice window. I parted my tassels and looked out. The band turned the corner, followed by a large crowd of strangers. Snowflower took my hand and guided me. We went outside, and Madam Wong introduced both sets of parents. Then my parents led the way to the ancestral temple, where my family hosted the first of many celebratory meals. Snowflower and other girls from our village sat around me. All through the banquet, I sang laments and the women replied. By now, I hadn't eaten a real meal for 7 days, and the smell of all that food made me dizzy. The next day, the day of the big singing hall, featured a formal lunch. My handiwork and all of the third-day wedding books were displayed. Mama and Aunt led me to the center table. As soon as I was seated, my mother-in-law set before me a bowl of soup that she'd prepared to symbolize the kindness of my new family. I would have given anything to have just a few sips of the broth. I could not see my mother-in-law's face through my veil, but when I looked down through the tassels and saw golden lilies that seemed as small as my own, I felt a wave of panic. She hadn't worn the special pair of shoes I'd made for her. I could see why. The embroidery on these shoes was far better than anything I had done. I was disgraced. Surely my parents were embarrassed and my in-laws disenchanted. At this terrible moment, Snowflower came to my side and took my arm again. Custom dictated that I leave the party, so she escorted me out of the temple and back home. Very late that night, my family returned home. If I was going to get any advice about bed business, it had to happen now. Mama came into the room and Snowflower left. Mama looked worried, and for a second I thought she'd come to tell me that my in-laws wanted to back out of the arrangement. She rested her cane on the bed and sat down beside me. "I have always told you that a true lady lets no ugliness into her life," she said, "and that only through pain will you find beauty." I nodded modestly, but inside I was practically screaming in terror. She had used these phrases again and again during my foot-binding. Could bed business be that bad? "I hope you will remember, Lily, that sometimes we can't avoid ugliness. You have to be brave. You have promised to be united for life. Be the lady you were meant to be." And then she stood up, balanced on her cane, and hobbled out of the room. I was not relieved by what she had said. My resolve, my adventurousness, and my strength had completely weakened. I truly felt like a bride, afraid, sad, and very scared now to leave my family. When Snowflower came back in and saw I was white with fear, she took my mother's spot on the bed and tried to comfort me. "For 10 years you have trained for this moment," she gently reassured me. "What about bed business?" "What about it? Your aunt and uncle have been happy doing this thing. Your mama and baba have done it enough to have many children. It can't be as hard as embroidery or cleaning." I felt a little better, but Snowflower wasn't done. "You will be a good mother because you are caring. And besides, I saw the way the Lus looked at you yesterday and today. Tell me everything. Remember when Lady Lu brought you the soup?" Of course I remembered. That was the beginning of what I imagined to be my lifetime of humiliation. "Your whole body trembled," Snowflower continued. "The entire room noticed. Everyone commented on your fragility combined with restraint. As you sat there with your head tilted down, showing what a perfect maiden you are, Lady Lu looked over you to her husband.
She smiled in approval, and he smiled back. You will see. Lady Lu is strict, but her heart is kind. But, and the way the whole Lu party examined your feet, oh, Lily, I'm sure everyone in my village is happy to know that one day you will be the new Lady Lu.
The next day, my in-laws arrived in Puwei early enough to pick me up and get me back to Tongku by late afternoon. Again, I wore my headdress, so I couldn't see anyone, but I heard my family's voices as we went through the final traditional calls and responses.
A woman will never become valuable if she doesn't leave her village, Mama cried out. Goodbye, Mama, I chanted back to her. Thank you for raising a worthless daughter.
Goodbye, daughter, Baba said softly.
With the sound of my father's voice, my tears came down in twin streams. I clung to the railing leading to the upstairs chamber. Suddenly, I didn't want to go.
As women, we are born to leave our home villages, Aunt sang out. You are like a bird flying into a cloud, never to return. Thank you, Aunt, for making me laugh. Thank you for showing me the true meaning of sorrow. Thank you for sharing your special talents with me.
Aunt's sobs echoed back to me from her dark place. My tears matched hers. Looking down, I saw Uncle's sun-browned hands on mine, pulling my fingers away from the railing.
Your flower-sitting chair waits for you, he said, his voice breaking with emotion.
Uncle.
Then I heard the voices of my siblings, each of them wishing me farewell. Outside, the band played louder. My hands reached out. Mama and Baba took them and helped me over the threshold. As I stepped over it, my tassels swung momentarily back and forth across my face. In little flashes, I saw my palanquin covered in flowers and red silk. My flower-sitting chair was beautiful. Everything I had been told since my betrothal was arranged 6 years ago flooded my mind. My husband was healthy, smart, and educated. His family was respected, rich, and generous. I had glimpsed these things already in the quality and quantity of my bride-price gifts, and now I saw them again with my flower-sitting chair. I loosened my grip on my parents' hands, and they let go of me. I took two blind steps forward and stopped. I couldn't see where I was going. I reached out my hands, longing for Snowflower to take them. As she always had, she came to me. She led me to the palanquin, opened the door, and whispered, Remember, we are old sames forever. Then she took something from inside her sleeve and tucked it inside my jacket. I made this for you. Read it on your way to Tongku. I will see you there. I got into the palanquin. The bearers lifted me up, and I was on my way. Mama, Aunt, Baba, Snowflower, and some friends followed my escorts and me to the edge of the village. I sat alone in the palanquin, crying. Why was I making such a fuss when I would return to my natal home in 3 days? I can explain it in this way. In our local dialect, the word for wife is the same as the word for guest. For the rest of my life, I would be merely a guest in my husband's home. Not the kind you treat with special meals, gifts of affection, or soft beds, but the kind who is forever viewed as a foreigner, alien, and suspect. I reached into my jacket and pulled out Snowflower's package. It was our fan, wrapped in cloth. I opened it. My eyes scanned the folds until I saw her message. Two birds in flight, hearts beating as one. The sun shines upon their wings, drenching them with healing warmth. The earth spreads below them, all theirs. In the garland at the top of the fan, two small birds soared together, my husband and me. I love that Snowflower had placed my husband in our dearest possession. Next, I spread open on my lap the handkerchief that had been wrapped around the fan. I saw she had embroidered a letter to me in our secret language to celebrate this most special moment. The letter began in the traditional opening to a bride. I feel knives in my heart as I write to you. We promised each other that we would never be a step apart, that a harsh word would never pass between us. These words came from our contract, and I smiled at the memory. Lily, we have been like a pair of mandarin ducks. Now everything changes. In the coming days, you will learn things about me. In my heart, I have been weeping, thinking you will no longer love me. Please know that whatever you think of me, my opinion of you will never change. Snowflower. Can you imagine how I felt?